Hi, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Introspectional. So happy that you're here to join us. And I'm here with two amazing guests, entertainment writers, and people who I love to talk to personally on the interwebs. So I will have them introduce themselves to you. First of all, Courtney, can you tell us a little about yourself?
Hi. Yeah, I have a podcast. Actually, I've worked on two podcasts, Bride and Court Talk. That's based out of peerfandom.com, where we do a lot of the entertainment writing, reviewing shows, interviews, and different things like that. The podcast that I have been mostly focusing on the past couple of years since the pandemic started way back when, we started recording every week and we never stopped, was Geek Girl Soup. They actually predated the pandemic, but like I've been hanging with them on the regular, talking movies. Like we just did Friday Night Lights. Two of them had never seen it before, and I did a whole rewatch of all five seasons just last week. I was like, oh my god, I missed the show so much. So yeah, and we do The Leftovers every year on for Departure Day. That's our anniversary. That's what we talk about.
That's awesome. And I usually say this to the end, but I want to push this to the beginning. Can you tell people your socials and where to find you?
Sure. I recently joined Threads, but I can't remember what that one is. I was trying to be different this time. You can also find me on Twitter. I thought I was going to depart from there, but everybody's still in. Threads hasn't figured its thing out yet. You can find me mostly on Twitter right now at Jendeve, at Jendeve. And also on Threads, I think it is Geek Love for Always.
Awesome. One of the reasons why I bring that up is because Courtney is one of my favorite people to talk to on the Twitters, because we will go back on for, if you find her, you'll find me eventually. And yeah, so one of the reasons why I bring that up. But another of one of my favorite people to talk to on the Twitter interwebs is Amanda Ray Prescott, who was on the second episode, and she is back.
Yes, finally, I'm back. It's been a while. So my name is Amanda Ray Prescott. I am a freelance journalist from Brooklyn. My main two publications I write for are Den of Geek and GBH Drama Club. That's a PBS station in Boston. So I do their blog for the television shows. Basically, my thing is all British television, or almost all British television all the time, especially the period dramas, aka the corset shows. That's my main beat. I also do sometimes a lot of the British mysteries and other things. Right now, I am recapping Grantchester for GBH Drama Club, which has been exciting because there's a lot of twists and turns and a cast departure announcement, which has been fascinating to track. On social media, I'm Amanda R. Prescott on Twitter still. I'm going to be there to bitter end, even though Elon took my blue check away. I'm going to be there to the end. And Threads, I'm the same name. I joined Blue Sky, but it is empty. It's my full name, .bsky social, whatever they call themselves today. And I'm also Amanda R. Prescott on Instagram. Although Instagram for me is often puppy photos and not talking to people.
Puppy photos seems to be a very solid use of your time because they are cute. And yes, we are in an age where we need cuteness and lightness and happy things, because it's so hard to find these days.
True, for sure. So true.
And I would also like to add, Amanda is not only the person that you see talking about the different British shows, but also like the British adjacent shows. So the Bridgertons, and in Sinnerton is a British show. We have embraced it basically. And I was a PBS kid growing up because no cable and PBS is where it's at. GBH is like where productions of PBS get done, which is actually cool. So I'm just like, oh my gosh, Amanda is where they make Arthur. That is
so funny. Though I've actually never been to the office because I started remote, so like I type all my stuff in and send it in remotely. I haven't been there yet. It's on my list to actually see the building, but it hasn't happened yet.
Hey, the remote life is very familiar these days. I'm connected to this thing I have never seen in my life. It's part of how we live. And actually, that's somewhat part of our conversation today as well. Mm-hmm. So today we are going to be talking about two things. One, if y'all don't know, which I don't know how you wouldn't know, the writer's strike is going on. They're on day 70-something. The actor's strike just started. It is strike summer, and there's Teamsters are striking, the LA hotel workers are striking. Basically, it seems like workers everywhere, and particularly in America, are like, bump this. Y'all ain't feeding us. Y'all ain't paying us. Our labor is worth so much, especially since you keep on making billions upon billions upon billions. And I'm just asking for a sandwich every day. Hey, everyone. This is Leticia from the future of this episode. It is July 18th today. And SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, they just released a chart, if you will, of their negotiations with the AMPTP. What they wanted, and how the AMPTP countered or did not. So when I originally said this phrase about y'all ain't feeding us and all I'm asking for is a sandwich, I thought I was being hyperbolic. I really did. But when SAG released their negotiations today, we learned that no, they are really trying not to give actors meal breaks, rest breaks, and the PAs, that's those are production assistants, are no longer getting some of the free lunch that they would get, which, given that they were paying basically minimum wage, sometimes the free lunch is the only thing that they would be able to eat. So, yeah, that's a thing. Anyway, back to the episode. And you're saying that's too much. Screw you. At least that's my summary of what's going on. And so one of the things I think is interesting is how we are all somewhat adjacent in the entertainment space, no contracts with SAG or WGA, but it's worth keeping up with. If anyone has listened to my early episodes, I mentioned me going to school for screenwriting. And actually at the writer strike in 07, I was a undergrad. And I actually took the train from Philadelphia to New York to get on the picket line. I still have my sign, hoping to do that at some point in time again. But one thing I wanted to ask Courtney and ex-Amanda, how do you see the issues currently that the writers and the actors are talking about? Have you been familiar with them before they went on strike? Was it something that took you by surprise? Like, what has been that groundswell that you saw or possibly didn't see?
I was mostly familiar with like the thing about the residuals where they only make so much money from syndication. And of course, syndication isn't what it was because now there's a smaller writer's room. And like most shows, like they're what, 13 episodes, if that at all?
Mostly like 8 to 10, less. Like 13 is a lot these days.
Yeah.
And 13 used to be a short season.
Yeah. Yeah. That used to be a short season. And now like 13 is like the longer end. And like people had been posting like, oh, I made this much for my residual check. I made 37 cents. Yay. Let me go buy I don't know what with that residual check. So that's when I knew about. Horrified today, just going through Twitter and threads, hearing all these different stories of other things that have happening. Like the thing with the AI. We knew AI was going to be an issue. That's another thing I was aware of. Like AI writing scripts. Attempting to write scripts. And now them talking about trying to have people's faces scanned to become the background actors instead of employing actual background actors and extras. Oh, let me scan your face for one day, pay you $200, and then I'm going to use your face forever. That's okay. That's okay with you. And then I've heard at least three different actors today talk about the fact that they got scanned and they didn't realize what it was for. They thought it was for special effects. Or they were told it was for something like that, for special effects, or the fact that they were going to use that image to make the crowd look bigger and fill up the crowd in the background scene, like something like Game of Thrones or something like that, where, oh, it's really 12 actors on the stage, but, you know, on the screen, it's like these thousands, just the same people over and over again. And like, they're doing this without their consent. I had no idea that part was happening. It's really outrageous. Who was it? Devin Sawa, he posted that he was in Final Destination. He posted that he didn't realize he had signed a contract where they'd be able to use like his image from the movie again. And he said he thought it was just for like promotion of the first movie. And later he showed up in the fifth movie from them using like that images from the first movie. And they never paid him for it. So all these stories are starting to come out now, and it's horrifying the way everything is being framed. And I'm going to stop talking, and I'm going to let Amanda talk because we're I know we're going to keep going with it.
Yeah. For me, there's a lot of these issues. I follow so many creatives on both sides of the Atlantic, like some of these issues we've been talking about for years. And part of me wonders, the whole shorter episode thing actually started out in Britain because their industry structure is completely different. Like a lot of times, 8 shows in Britain's a lot of episodes, unless you're talking about soap operas and stuff like that, because they can go on forever. But most of the times you're going to get things like 4-3 episodes a season. Like, again, there's smaller crews. Like a lot of times it could just be one single writer writing an entire show. But I think the American industry caught on to that system because they realized the way of saving money. And they're like, oh, wait, we don't have to pay as many people if we just pay one person to do everything. But again, the structure is set up completely differently. And I think the streaming and cable television adopted that model because they wanted to cut costs. So it is interesting to see. I knew about the AI stuff for a while because I am in journalism industry. So people were afraid of AI replacing our jobs for a while now. So yeah, the part of actors being scanned as AI didn't surprise me. The residual stuff didn't surprise me either because there's been arguments about the streamers not taking residual seriously for a while now. And all the controversy over all these streamers deleting shows before people see it because then they don't want to pay residuals or use it as a tax write-off if they're like, how did this thing not make money if you're not telling us what the ratings are? Or this show got low ratings and we're going to take it off our streaming channel, but like you didn't promote it in the first place.
One thing I want to get back to you on about the whole low ratings thing, because it's like, you're not sharing what those ratings are. Mm-hmm. So how do we know that these are low rated shows? If you look at like the Nielsen ratings for network shows, you can see week over week, okay, how many millions of people are not watching this? What is going on, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas with the streamers, like they hold that information so tightly. And part of it, as far as I understand, is about the revenue, because the revenue is about continually getting new subscribers, as opposed to when we're focusing on broadcast, where that revenue is how many people are seeing this piece of media. Which the thing that's really getting me is because the ads, the new like version where it's, oh, you can have this service for free, like Pluto TV or Tubi, but they have ads in it, which is why it's free. And so I would think that you getting residuals from an ad-supported streamer would make sense since it's very close to what broadcast was doing in the first place. But they're still trying to hide the money, which like I think really sucks. Also, I like the idea, even on, again, something like Tubi or Pluto TV, that you have these older shows. You have Murder, She Wrote, and Matlock, and even those, like, 90s shows that I love that there was one season of it. Like, I rewatched Queen of Swords recently. No one's talking about Queen of Swords. No one cares about it. However, the idea that I can watch this old behind show and maybe some actor or performer get some residual for that, that's nice. Now, granted, My Little Behind may only contribute 5 cents, but that's 5 more cents than he had before, and I'm happy for the opportunity. You know, but it's just, it's so messy, it's so toxic, and it's heartless. Because what it seems that they're trying to do, whether it's with writers or even directors, even though they accepted the deal, and actors, is like separate humans from the creative process, separate the process from the product. And they're like, if we could just pump out the product, then that's what matters. And it's no. And that's not why anyone got into this. No one got into it because they're just like, we're just trying to pump things out. They're like, I wanted to create. That's the point. And I was telling someone about some of the things with the AI and all that, but I was like, it's like the evil plot that Syndrome had in The Incredibles. You're just like, oh, everyone can be super. Everyone through the AI or whatever can be an actor. When everyone can do this, it won't matter.
In the reality, they are so far removed from the reality of just life, period. And we can talk about it in a moment, but just think of it, like you're talking about scanning folks background and extras. Like when I go and I watch a movie, I want to see something new. I don't want to see the same thing redone over and over again. And you're telling me that you're going to have these same people appearing like just for the next 90 years, and I'm never going to see a new face, a new talent ever again. I'm never going to see an actual person. Like for me, the creativity comes in from the individual, from that person. What y'all are talking about is taking the soul out of the art. And that's whether it's for the writing, that's if it's the song, it's whatever. And that's the part that they've lost or that they want us to lose. And I don't want to ever see that happen. Their money be damned. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to curse again.
Cursing is fine.
Thank you.
It is a good point too. I think, especially we're talking about these diversity debates. So you're just going to have the same white people on the screen all the time. This is the thing. Because again, every single recent show that has even tried to do anything, either whether it's on not just on race issues, but other issues as well, there are people who've complained that they're seeing this type of representation on screen. So it's okay. So you just want to go back to how it was 50, 60 years ago, where you never saw anybody black, never saw anybody gay, never saw anybody with disabilities. No one else, no other ethnicities, nothing. Oh, like, okay, I guess that's what y'all want. But obviously there's going to be a lot of pushback on that. But I think the AI debate somewhat obscures it. It is a way to make media less diverse.
Yeah, I want to hit that. And actually, there's two things I'm thinking of. One, thinking of one, the plot of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom by August Wilson and the pushback that Ma Rainey had against recording her voice. Because she was like, once they put it on there on that record, then they're going to sell all over the place and I won't see a dime. Once they do that, and not wrong. And with new technologies, once something is packaged and product, it is then separated from the people who are making it. You know, and in many ways, as technology has, I'll say evolved, not progressed, evolved. That has continued to happen in many ways, whether it's the clothes we wear, whether it's the things that we buy. So many things have been separated from human hands. And when you don't have to pay for labor, or you're paying significantly less for labor, yes, the consumer gets something cheaper, but then the labor gets devalued. And so it's just interesting to think about where we are on this continuum. And then what you're saying about AI, Amanda, one thing that really irritates me when people talk about, not people talking about diversity, but people who are like anti, rawr, what are you trying to do? There's no more parts for white people anymore and no one loves me. I'm just like, ay. But one of the things that really gets me is if you talk about just the history of the movies, which starts in the early 1900s to now, talking about 100 years. And for 80 of those 100 years, you had mostly white folks writing the scripts, making, producing the movies, being the directors. So you have about 80 years of strictly Eurocentric content. And then about 10 years of tokenized content of maybe we'll let a few people of color in and maybe we'll let a few more openly LGBTQ people in. And about another 10 years of whatever we have now, which is not parody, but is more than it was. And people are like, okay, now it's too much. Now we need to go, excuse me, we have 80 years of backlog to account for before we're even close. And so even thinking about AI, and AI is particularly the generative AI that can possibly write scripts or write media, it will be trained on older scripts. It will be trained on what's already there. So what will be put in place will be the patterns that were in those scripts for that 80 years of media coming from almost exclusively one cultural lens. And so what it will generate is not something that will be from a culture that hasn't really had a chance to speak. And even if that's in the sauce, it won't dominate that particular script, whatever it creates. So it's just one of those things where I'm like, wow. And I even think about this far in the future. I'm Star Trek nerd. Who doesn't love Star Trek? I love Trek. But one of the things I've talked about before, maybe not here, but in one of the newest Star Trek's Discovery, and in Picard, we have Black people there who have naturally textured hair. And I'm like, does this mean that there's a Black barber in the future? There's coconut oil? Because if there's not, what that would mean is that someone decided that Black culture was important enough to program into something to say, okay, here's how you're going to have your EHH. Emergency hairdresser hologram, and they're going to know how to do Black hair. And so thinking about what are we inputting that allows us to create something that works in the future is a question. Yeah, wow, that was a longer monologue than I anticipated. Sorry, guys.
No, that was a good one, actually, because more you said that, I was like, more thinking, yeah, that is definitely what is being put into right there right now is not going to benefit the larger population in the future. And in some ways, maybe that's the intent.
I am currently writing a script about 1850s Boston, and particularly the Black abolitionists in 1850s Boston. The amount of information that I'm finding out while public, but not in the public imagination, is insane. I'm finding Black doctors and lawyers, seafarers, skilled seamstresses who were doing all of this work in the time where people were still slaves. And the fact that one narrative of Black people being oppressed and hurt is over the other narrative of Black folks taking their life into their own hands and being productive and even revolutionary.
If you think about it, history has erased so much of what we know about many eras in the past. Purposely. Yeah, I see this all the time when I'm talking to people about these British dramas where, like, how dare Black people be in X space before, for the British dramas, usually 1948 or World War II in general is usually their cutoff of between the past and, like, living history, living memory, and quote-unquote modern era. So they're always surprised. I'm like, there were people there. We were there. The records have been erased. Again, it's the direction of conversation. Like, for example, 1850s Boston, so many people are talking about what's going on in the South. Are they really paying attention to what's happening in New York or Boston? Like, people are not talking about these things. It's the same thing when the Gilded Age came out. People were like, what do you mean Peggy had money? And me being a historian, I'm like, duh. There were people like, wait, why isn't she not in Harlem? I'm like, that's 50 years later. They didn't have a context that entire era, because a lot of times what we know about that era is just basically ride 'em up cowboy. Or if they're talking about New York, it's just the rich white people on Wall Street, like not anybody else. People didn't even know because they thought they were making it up. They thought they were making it up to be quote unquote woke. I'm like, the person who's the screenwriter for the Gilded Age is actually one of the most conservative writers out there right now. He realized, though, from his errors in past shows that he had to switch things up and get advisors for Gilded Age. I was like, yeah, this is the same thing. It's like, what we know about history is often wrong, and it's wrong on purpose. It's whitewashed on purpose.
Yeah,
wrong on purpose and limited.
Yeah, just think of the reaction when Watchmen aired that episode, like on the Tulsa massacre. There were so many people who didn't know the history of that. Like I've known the history just for a couple of years because, like, I loved doing research on just different subjects and everything, and I'd heard about it. But we saw it in that show and also on Lovecraft Country, where we saw more of that. So there's just so much history, like you were just saying, that we haven't even scratched the surface of material that could be covered if they truly had the intent to do it like they wanted to. But like you said, I feel like they just want to take it back to the way it was, and they want to focus on their template and keep it there. And we've seen recently where all these diversity hires that they had pledged to bring in, like, where those people are gone. They've either been let go or they've resigned.
And I actually just showed my mother, we were just talking about that. There's an infographic from a company, I believe, up in Canada. But if you look up the problem in quotes, woman of color in the workplace, and it basically breaks down, like, what happens when it's, oh, we're going to bring this woman of color into our workplace and she will solve all our diversity problems and we love her. And then she actually tries to make changes. And then we're like, no, why are you trying to change us? And then we say, you're not a good fit. And then you leave. And this particular infographic, I've sent it to friends, I've sent it to so many different people when that happens, whether it's corporate, whether it's a social organization, whether it's a volunteer, or even a fan organization, where they're like, oh, we realize there are no people of color here, no diversity, we will bring you in. And they're like, okay, great. And they're like, okay, well, you probably should look at this and look at this.
Just trying to say that we're wrong and we're evil. I don't think this is going to break anymore because I wasn't trying to change. No.
It's very challenging. And you can also see the difference when sometimes it does work. But usually those are people who have done the work themselves already and have sat with, okay, let's really think about what would it take for someone with a different culture and a different background to feel welcome here, besides just being like, oh, we're nice people, and not let me investigate the deeper prejudices that I might have, not because I'm an evil person, but because I live in a society that's never forced me to question my beliefs. And now I have to. But that takes a level of humility, which a lot of people are not accustomed to.
It's funny, from my point of view, a lot of these things are magnified in British media when you're talking about diversity issues, because the thing is, they are about 30 years behind America on these conversations. Imagine a media landscape, y'all, where there is no Tyler Perry, there is no Oprah, no BT. I mean, for all of their back and forth on what are they problematic or not, but imagine that there is no like official UK equivalent of any of those things. There's no Telemundo, there's no none of that, like all that. There's no logo. All those groups we have TV channels for in America does not exist in the UK. All of their media has to go through the white establishment. And obviously things that are going to go too far against the establishment are not going to get through. And people who want to challenge the establishment are not going to get through. I think I am pointing this out to a lot of the conversation about the monarchy. Like, you have to think about this in mind, that a couple of old white guys control their entire media landscape. So yeah, this is where the diversity conversation gets really interesting. It's like, even seeing one actor on the screen half the time, it's like progress, just scary. Even something as simple as, oh, the director in one episode of A Person of Color, wow, those little incremental things you have to celebrate, because it is dire out there in UK television sometimes. Like, there's a lot. It's like, oh my gosh, y'all had one guest star in that kind of environment. So often it turns into a competition, and then people get left behind. So a lot of times the US debates to me are like, wait, wow, y'all are talking about things that, like, I think the Brits would dream of.
Something strange, as I've also done some thoughts and research when it comes to like British media and also like the government itself. When we talk about things like universal healthcare or things that would help like everybody in America, it can be really hard to get it through, because it feels like there's a group of people. It's like, but if you get it to everyone, the blacks will get it. And we don't want that. Which is funny, because I feel like in the UK, since a lot of minorities have been minoritized more or quieted more, they're like, okay, we have all of this stuff. Like, you have, even though socialized healthcare is not like the godsend that we like to think it is, it does exist. And then thinking about like even British media, we have the BBC and all that, like so many things are not controlled by the government, but are government influenced. And in some ways, particularly with funding for media or funding for the arts, that's like a lot of these things are like already like line items that like people don't argue about. Okay, we figure that out. Okay, we fund the arts. Whereas I feel like in America, we're like, we might fund the arts maybe, but why? I just remember that somewhat when I went over to the UK to study theater. It was very much, oh yeah, we always do this. So I find, and even thinking about going all the way back when Frederick Douglass went to the UK, leaving America, he was like, oh my gosh, they like treat me cool here, no one's bothering me. Reminds me of this similar experience of black soldiers in World War II being like, I love France, no one gives me crap. Now that has obviously changed, but again, talking about World War II. And so it's interesting, because while I feel like we in America have had this conversation around diversity and what it means and, you know, how this impacts our daily lives, we also have this, I don't know, pushback of people not wanting to share their resources, because what if we get it too? And then whether or not people fear that, but then the conversations that they don't have, it's complicated. I don't even know if it makes sense.
I will say, you made total sense.
You did, but also there's a equal number of folks in the UK who do not want to see any changes, like, at all. But I also think too, in the UK, there's also a class divide that comes
into effect. Class and, thing. Ooh.
Yeah.
And like, we have it too, but they have legacy.
Yeah.
And this is where we're gonna stop the episode, friends. So after this section of the conversation, it actually makes a hard left into the water, where we start talking about a little mermaid.
So I feel like that turn is a little abrupt, even if you're expecting it. So I'm actually going to divide this episode into two episodes. So this one, as you heard, is about the strike, but also a little bit about, you know, diversity and some of it into human rights, a little politics, and class issues. So, you know, I think that's important, and especially when we're talking about AI, and we're talking about the arts, and we're talking about things in the grand scheme of things of how media fits into our lives and what it tells us about ourselves and our society. So thank you for sticking around for this long. Now, in regard to the WGA and SAG strikes specifically, if you want to support the strike, probably the best way to do it, one, is to share some of the information that SAG and the WGA are putting out. Make sure people understand the issues. They understand things about streaming, residuals, AI, but also the working conditions. Also something like that was released today where studios are not paying people on time and refuse to start. Like, these are just fundamental working conditions that everyone should be able to understand and understand that the studios are not doing what they are supposed to do. So clearly I am in support of the strikes. Also, one thing you can do is support the various community funds that are around. So these different community funds help people with their groceries, help people with their livelihoods who are currently affected by the strike. So helping to fund that is also a huge assist. If there are pickets in your area, you can join the picket, but you can also give people water, give people snacks. Picketing in these long, hot summer days is a lot. Also, if you haven't already, I recommend reading up on unions and all the things that we have today that we often take for granted that are due to unions, such as weekends, such as Labor Day, such a typical 8-hour workday when people used to have pensions, restrictions on child labor, workplace safety. So definitely do your research and understand what these labor actions are about. Also, it's not just SAG that is striking or the WGA. Teamsters, the Hotel Workers of LA, UPS. There are strikes going on all over the country for all different types of labor. Finally, you may have some questions about my particular podcast and the type of topics that I cover on the show. Because what I typically cover is some version of media or media analysis. So the guidance from SAG has come out specifically around influencers, broadcast, and fans. And one of the things they said specifically is that when it comes to reviews and critical analysis, that is not crossing the picket line as promoting would be. So promoting, as defined by the WGA, seems to be more of doing activities before a film comes out to engage an audience, to try to get them to attend, which is different than after a film has already appeared and giving your critique of it. So I should be fine with my content. I will let you know if and when that changes. But yeah, want to let you know that. Again, we here at Inspectional, which is really just me, are absolutely 100% in support of the strike. Union strong, solidarity forever. See you later.